I'm Mark Purcell, and this is the Book Club at 91.7 here on WVXU and WMUB. Good morning. On the phone with me is Sharonee Green. She's written a book called Remember Me to Miss Louisa, Hidden Black-White Intimacies in Antebellum America. It's a fascinating subject and made more fascinating by the role that Cincinnati plays in this book and in that hidden history. Sharonee Green, welcome to the Book Club at 91.7.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
I've read a lot about master-slave relationships before and after the Civil War, but this is one aspect I really have not seen much material on, and I'm curious what set you on the journey to writing Remember Me to Miss Louisa. What did you find that sparked your interest?
Well, I have to go back a bit, but long story short, I was living in New York City. I was not intending to go back to school, but the towers fell. I literally saw the towers fall. And I said, if the world's coming to an end, I'm going to figure something else out. I can't, like, whatever, just go through life like this. But long story short, I ended up being a substitute teacher, discovered Deborah Gray White's now classic study on black women in the plantation South, as it is called, and stumbled upon two words, fancy girls. This is the brand name for enslaved women who were sold for use as, and I'll put it in quotes, concubines or mistresses or prostitutes. So as a way to just keep my mind in place, I lived in Manhattan, I'm smelling smoke, I see all the missing, you know, these people are missing signs. I started writing stories about what I thought these women's lives were like. Shared it with a friend who was a New York editor, you know, big trade house, and she said, go find some real women. Forget the fiction. Go find real women. I said, how do you do that? She said, you got to find an archive. You got to go back to school. And I did. And I read F. Baptist's now very well-known article on Rice Ballard. He was a Virginia domestic slave trader. He left behind an enormous, you know, number of letters and business documents, and he and his fellow traders are talking about just their daily lives as slave traders, but they also start talking about these women. And being a former journalist, it wasn't enough just to read his article. I was like, I want to go see these letters myself. They're at UNC Chapel Hill. So I ended up going to grad school. I would send away for these boxes of microfilm, and for weeks just go letter to letter, just rolling letter to letter, and I'm just hearing the voices of white men, white men, white men, white men. And then one day, I'll never forget it, I was at the University of Chicago's Regenstein Library, and I was reading a letter that was clearly written by someone who wasn't white and wasn't a man. It was a woman of color named Avinia White. And in this letter, written in 1838, she is in Cincinnati. It is clear that she is newly freed. Beside her is another woman and four children. Rice Ballard freed her and this woman and these four children who might have been his children. And then I kept reading, and there was another letter from her, and there was another letter. And so over a period of a year and a half, she's asking him for assistance, she and the other woman, whose name is Susan. They're trying to find work. They want to be closer to the river because, as you know, the river is one of the primary sources of income. Cincinnati's a busy, busy port town before the Civil War. And she can't find the kind of work she wants, partly because the river is low for part, you know, moments of the year the river's going to be low. I think you know about that. And so he sends her the money. And it tripped me. I said, you know, I thought I was going to write this, you know, article or seminar paper where the women are only the victims. But to me, no matter her ongoing oppression, there was some kind of triumph here. And I wanted to know if this was an isolated case. And it turns out that Cincinnati was ground zero for the resettlement of such women and children. A lot of them were of mixed race. In fact, Cincinnati had the highest per capita population of people of color who were of mixed race outside of the South. The only place where you see numbers that are larger would be New Orleans, okay? So what you're seeing happening is that Mississippi-Ohio River network was the way that men like Rice Ballard would sort of shepherd these women and children to freedom. And I want you to know, again, that the horrors of slavery are still there. You might imagine that a lot of these women and children never thought for a moment that their troubles would be over simply because they were on free soil. There was an abolitionist presence, as we know, in Cincinnati, but as the century matured, we see a lot of immigrants settling in the area. They are not wanting people of color there because of job competition. So she's up against this too. So I began to find other women, including Louisa Piquet. She was born in Columbia, South Carolina. Her father was white. She was sold twice. She ends up in New Orleans. She is a concubine, I'll use that word in quotes again, of an aging New Orleans man who, on his deathbed, promises to free her and their two children. And indeed, he does. She, too, ends up in Cincinnati. And then one of the most striking cases involves a family from Huntsville, Alabama. Their father, and we're talking about 9 children, from 5 enslaved women, 1 man, he frees them and leaves them $2.2 million. This is the value of his estate. On the eve of the Civil War, he is dying. That's worth $5.5 million in today's currency. And I'm like, okay, here's a pattern here. And what's really interesting about it, Mark, is that this was happening quietly. Often judges and prominent individuals, including Stephen Douglas, a senator in Illinois, William Seward, a senator in New York, these are prominent people who are debating critical issues of the day. They are being called on from time to time to answer one question: where do we put these women and children? So even though these men, for many, many reasons, appear to be scoundrels, and in fact were, some of them were vile individuals, they were complicated people. Very complex people. There was something in them that made it possible for them to financially invest and emotionally invest in the future of certain women and children. And as I continued through grad school, I would read different books with footnotes of, you know, other cases that begin to look like one huge pile that I couldn't ignore. And that's how we ended up with this book.
I'm speaking with Sharon E. Green, a professor of American history at the University of Alabama, Roll Tide. She is also the author of the book Remember Me to Miss Louisa, Hidden Black White Intimacies in Antebellum America. You can learn more about it at our website, wvxu.org. And Sharon E., quite often when we hear about master-slave relationships, we hear about the vile nature of things, people being taken advantage of and beaten. But it's clear in the three stories that you follow in Remember Me to Miss Louisa that there was also some love. I mean, granted, it was somewhat qualified, but I was extremely surprised at the intimacy that existed between these men and women.
Yes, especially, I think, with the children, you actually hear them use the word pa. You didn't send me the inscription on Pa's tombstone. He didn't say our master, right?
Mm-hmm.
And with the kids in Huntsville, they had a cousins, and their cousins were freed by their father, who was the brother of the 9 children, their master. But here's the thing. When they refer to their master's brother, they didn't, say, Mr. Townsend. They called him Uncle Edmund. It's amazing.
And I want to go back to Cincinnati quickly, because we'll go back to Rice Ballard and his relationship with the two women and the 4 kids. And he set them up in Cincinnati and set up his wife in Louisville, just 140 miles down the river, if you may. And part of it was he moved between both worlds. And it was interesting in his case, and in the case of some of the others, that they were men who acted one way but said something entirely different. And there was quite a juxtaposition about their private life and the public life they held.
Absolutely. These, again, were men who were participants in critical issues of the day. In Rice Ballard's archive, which is at UNC Chapel Hill, yeah, you'll see letters between him and even friends back home in Virginia. In one letter, they're talking about President Polk and the war he started with the Mexicans. I mean, every major narrative that you can think of that happens before the Civil War, even the Civil War itself, you're going to find it in these archives. But if you look at the letters that you might ordinarily just put to the side because you go, I don't know what to make of this letter. If you look at them and you critically read them, you will see that these, again, were very complicated men. Avinia White, the woman I mentioned before, who wrote 5 letters that survive in his papers, she actually uses the word love. I say in the book that it may have been her way of performing something in order to be strategic and get something from him, but I can't be sure. I wasn't there. I don't think any of these people who wrote these letters thought that they would have audiences beyond, you know, the intended recipient. But here's the thing. What I was most struck by in her last letter, which was mailed on the eve of his marriage to Louise, the woman he sets up in Louisville, she says, "If you have forgotten me, I hope you have not forgotten the children." That, to me, is more persuasive than any utterance of love. She is aware, and her landlord is aware that something's tugging at him. And I'm not going to say it's tugging at his heart, but a man who wants to be found leaves his address. He's made it possible for these women to stay in touch with him. I wonder about, with our ongoing interest in genealogy, how many other letters are out there like that that we don't talk about because it's so difficult to make sense of that. And ongoing racial tensions. And if you read the epilogue, there's a real-life young man here in Alabama who was a repairman in my home. And throughout the course of working on what he was repairing, he wanted to know more about what I did. And he told me about one of his ancestors. His family apparently still lives on the land this man owned. They have access to all of his papers. He is a white man who married not one, not two, but 3 different black women.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
Truly.
He married them.
And in a day and age where a lot of times those interracial relations were against the law.
Right. As we get closer to the American Revolution, you're going to see increasingly restrictions on how black and white bodies come together. And when I say that, I mean literally, physically, how we name who this person is. There's a report in the middle of the 18th century of a South Carolina man who was accused of loving an enslaved woman more than he loved his wife. And that woman basically disappears from the record. I don't know if she was sold off or what. So this is, I think it was like 1749 when this happens. By the time you get to the 1820s, 1830s, by then, 1 out of every 3 steamboats coming in and out of Cincinnati was manufactured there in Cincinnati. So we're talking about industrializing world where people can move through space and commerce moves through space and folks can be all in your business because they just saw you here and then they saw you there and you were with this woman as opposed to moments or days when we were more isolated. So news travels. And it makes sense that Rice Ballard would put his family, the white family, in Louisville. He's making all his money in the lower South, in Mississippi and in Arkansas. Yeah, a lot of men did carry on relations with enslaved women, but this must have been an unusual case. He's going to remove them from slave territory long before the restrictions on free people of color. He couldn't just free them in the 1850s. In the 1850s, you have to free them and then remove them. Even before that, those laws were passed, he decided, I'm going to go ahead and move them out of here, right? So not only does he move them out, the woman he marries, he never even settles her in the lower South. And I'm now wondering, and I kind of go there in the book, maybe he intended to bring one of those women, maybe Avinia, back to the lower South. She definitely disappears from the record, appears to disappear from the record after that awful mob attack in Cincinnati in 1841. Maybe she was so horrified, she said to him, get me the heck out of here. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But she disappears from the record in 1841.
Many fascinating facets to the story and in the book, and we have barely scratched the surface, Sharony. But thank you for providing some food for thought and as our world continues to evolve. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark, for talking to me today and permitting me to share what little bit I've found, because there's still so much, again, out there. And part of my growing interest in sharing this story is not just to see the book read, but to challenge people to think about what our shared past really looked like, what it really looked like, and then think about whether it's possible to make adjustments on some of our attitudes across the racial line today. The ugliness is always going to be there, but can we think about how complicated we are, even now?
I've been speaking with Sharonee Green, the author of the book Remember Me to Miss Louisa, Hidden Black-White Intimacies in Antebellum America. Many stories that will be very surprising to you about the masters and women of color who had very intimate relationships. It's a very surprising book. You can learn more about it at our website, wvxu.org. This is The Book Club at 91.7.